punish now. Walk the streets are screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today I want to talk about Obama's farewell speech here on Tuesday, I think it was, the 10th, where he gave his final presentation to the American people. Big gala event in Chicago, kind of an attempt to make it look something like his initial address there. Remember that great address presentation in 2008 when he got elected? And so much hope, and the streets were full of people, millions. Well, this was an indoor event, and not just because of the weather, but very clearly it showed not as much energy, hope, anticipation of a better future before us. No, it was a rather downbeat speech, I thought, comparatively to 2008, right? And instead of celebrating the unity of all those who had elected him back in 2008, you know, now the theme was warning listeners that the country has become more divided than ever in the intervening 8 years. Democracy was threatened on many fronts, cultural, legal, economic, and that the people now had to take up the fight that he apparently did not win in the last 8 years because, you know, the theme was we have less solidarity as a people than ever before. And he's true. That's true, but it's kind of a self-indictment of what went on the last 8 years. Of course, it's not all his fault. I wouldn't be the first to say that it was all his fault. The Republicans had a very effective strategy here of just playing hardball with him on every step, saying no, no, no. And of course, the Democrats would never do that. They don't have the fortitude to play hardball. You know, McConnell and the Republicans in the House continually played hardball with him, and every time he got up to bat, they threw a beanball at him, and he struck out every time and quietly, submissively went back to the dugout, to use a metaphor here. And that's the story, I think, of the last 8 years here. You know, he had a majority in both houses. He had such an opportunity historically to do something in 2009-10. Even the Recovery Act, his 2009 stimulus, he pulled back. You know, guys like Larry Summers told him, oh, you can't give so much tax cuts to consumers. You know, you got to give them the businesses. And, oh, you can't spend more than $787 billion because the economy just can't absorb anymore. Yeah, that was the argument that Summers, you know, gave, and other appointees from the financial side that Obama quickly filled his administration with. You know, he sounded like the progressive left candidate, you know, but it was a false progressivism. And we saw how quickly, once he started appointing bankers to run the show. And his number one focus was bailing out the banks and bailing out you know, insurance companies like AIG, bailing out the auto companies with big cash infusions. The central bank, of course, was the main way, the Federal Reserve, that the banking system was bailed out to the tune of over $10 trillion easily, conservatively. You know, $4 trillion alone with QE, quantitative easing, but a lot of other direct bailout measures. I've talked about that before. You know, if you want a history of his first term economically, my book written in 2012, Obama's Economy, Recovery for the Few, is really a blow-by-blow description of his positions when he jumped into the race late here in 2008. pushed forward by Chicago big money, the Pritzkers, and so forth. That book is reviewed also on my blog, jackerasmus.com. You can read it there by Dr. Yin Tang, a review of the book. I'll be writing another update to Obama and his 8 years of economic, I wouldn't say leadership, kind of drift. And back to his speech, you know, let's go over his speech here a little bit, and you can see how the spin is at work, you know, about the legacy of Barack Obama here. Don't get me wrong, my criticisms of Obama do not constitute appraisal of Donald Trump. You know, the way I see it historically, this neoliberal offensive that was put into place in the late 70s when we had a crisis of the 70s reflected corporate America and capitalists injecting themselves more directly into the political process in order to accelerate and accentuate new policies, new sets of policies to their benefit. You know, drive down wages, destroy organized labor, bring your foreign competitors to heel in Japan and Europe, raise interest rates, you know, to 18-20% in order to make American workers and consumers pay for the inflation of the 70s, which was caused mostly by Nixon programs and the Saudis and OPEC driving up oil prices. In other words, make us pay for causes that were policy and beyond our causes as consumers and workers, but we had to pay for it. You know, that was what raising interest rates to 18% by the Federal Reserve, the central bank, was all about. You know, slow down the economy, create the 81-82 recession, which was Ronald Reagan's, one of his great contributions, his legacies. I've written about that before, too. You can read that on my blog. Of course, he gave us unending fiscal deficits rising and trade deficits rising and so forth. Reagan was a disaster. But we've got, you know, every time these presidents leave, there's this big deal about saying, oh, the great accomplishments they've made and so forth, which is just nonsense. Anyway, looking at his speech, Obama's speech, here's some juicy quotes, right? America is a better, stronger place by almost every measure. Come on. He just said that we're more divided than ever before, and democracy is being threatened on all kinds of fronts, unlike ever before, and people are going to have to take up the struggle where he failed. And then he says we're stronger, better place by every measure. Kind of self-contradictory, but it rings nice, you know. And you pause and you let all your party hacks in the audience cheer, right? And then he says we remain the wealthiest, most powerful, most respected nation in the world. Quote unquote. That was a quote, direct quote, right? A direct quote. America is the better. Is a better, stronger place by almost every measure. Quote. Second quote. We remain the wealthiest, most powerful, most respected nation in the world. Well, we're certainly the wealthiest, but that doesn't say anything about how the wealth is distributed, does it, right? Yeah, you can add up the total wealth, but if 97% of all the gains in national income have accrued to the wealthiest 1% households in the last 8 years. We may be aggregate wealthiest, but it's the 1% who got all the wealth. Right? Most powerful? Yeah, still. You know, we keep putting $1 trillion into defense every year, if you call military powerful. But certainly not so powerful in terms of ideas and values around the world, because people are rejecting around the world U.S. leadership. And even militarily, you know, these conflicts that have erupted in the Middle East and so forth, U.S. made a mess out of all of that. But yet they say, oh, that's an example of U.S. power. Mm. All right. Most respected, well, you know, that one doesn't even need a explanation here. More nations and more peoples around the world dislike America than ever before, you know, for a whole number of reasons. Okay, so, you know, that's another piece of political BS, right? And then he says, quote, the wealthy are paying their fair share of taxes. Wow. Unquote. You really think so? Hmm? You know how much tax cuts we've given them under Obama? Them, meaning corporations and investors? Well, Obama comes into office, 2008. Part of his $787 billion plan is $300 billion in tax cuts, which get hoarded. They don't get spent. Okay, so that's the first $300 billion. Then he immediately extends, for 2 years, he extends the Bush tax cuts. Bush gave $3.4 trillion, 80% of which went to the wealthiest 1% investors. Okay, Bush gives $3.5 trillion, and that's a lowball estimate, by the way. That's just based on his first term, 2001-04. Tax cuts, not what was extended and came later in piecemeal, industry by industry. Anyway, probably more like $5 trillion. But, you know, let's just say the study by different tax research houses and research companies, you know, profit, non-profit, indicate about $3.5 to $3.7 trillion. Okay, that was Bush. Well, Obama comes, he gets $300 billion, cuts back, takes out of what Congress proposed in tax cuts for consumers and households in 2009. He deleted that, as his buddy Larry Summers suggested. And then he extends the Bush tax cuts by 2 years, okay, from 2010 to 2012, at the cost of another $800 billion, right? 2010, an $800 billion tax cut deal. $450 billion of that was Bush extensions and more so. All right, and then 2012, what does he do? He caves into the Republican Congress that he loses in 2010 because of his policies, loses control of Congress, and he caves in and he agrees to extend the Bush tax cuts for another decade at the cost of $5 trillion. Okay, I'm not sure if we're on the air here. Hopefully we are. Apparently the internet dropped, and we lost our communication here. So hopefully some of you have remained on, and those who aren't will be able to listen to the show without the music in between. The drop here, it's about 5 minutes or so in which the internet went down, and we're back on. Okay, well, we're talking about Obama's farewell speech. And addressed, okay? And some choice quotes from that farewell address and my analysis of it and debunking some of the claims here, like we're in a better, stronger place by any measure since 2008, and we've remained the wealthiest, most powerful, most respected nation in the world, or the wealthy are paying their fair share of taxes, which, of course, I was commenting on here when everything dropped, the fact that the wealthy has accrued 97% of the income gains since 2008, which is one of his biggest legacies. His other big legacy, I believe, is going to be the implosion of the Democratic Party itself. You know, Democratic Party now is really limited to two enclaves on the West Coast and in the Northeast. Everything in between has turned red, turned Republican just about. And it happened on his watch. You know, he started out with a majority in both houses of Congress and the presidency, could have achieved great things, but was timid and would not confront the Republican opposition. Went easy with them, allowed them to overly, even though they were a minority in both houses of Congress, allowed the Republicans to have a big say in the bailout programs and so forth for 2 years. And then in 2010, when the economy was still not recovering, we were still losing jobs, he loses the House in the midterm elections in 2010, and the Republicans start playing hardball with him ever after, right? Unlike the Democrats, who play softball when they're in power, and the Republicans get to have a big influence on policies, when the Republicans are in power, or when it's a split Congress, they play hardball, and the Democrats don't get to do anything. You see, that's the difference between these two parties, right? One's tough, and the other's milquetoast. And that's really what's happened here since 2010. Historically, it's interesting because, you know, a similarity, if you look at history here, in 1932, FDR comes to power and engages in a kind of pro-corporate recovery policy. This is not the New Deal when he first comes into office. You know, this is bail out the banks and try to get help corporations and businesses to raise prices. That's what the National Recovery Act of 1933 was all about. But it didn't work. And after 2 years, the economy of going sideways, barely growing, starts to get weak again, 1934, in the summer of 34, just like in 2010. But what did FDR do? FDR doubled down and went out to the people and said, okay, you know, elect us Democrats again in 34 in the midterm elections, and we will have a new deal for Main Street. We will bail out Main Street. And the Republicans and business hated him for that. Oh, boy, they attacked him. You know, there was even, you know, some evidence there was an attempted coup that was spoiled. That's been sealed ever since, by the way. There were House investigations on that in Congress, and those records have been sealed ever since. The evidence of a coup against FDR in 1934, which was revealed by this Marine General Smedley, that the coup was brewing, and apparently somehow Henry Ford was involved in it. The whole idea was to have another march on Washington, the bonus march by ex-soldiers claiming their bonus, which Hoover wouldn't pay them, and to arm those soldiers when they marched on Washington and create a coup situation. Well, anyway, that was revealed and stopped. But, you know, notwithstanding that kind of attack on FDR, FDR went forward and he said, we're going to give you a new deal. And as a result of that, people said, okay. And in 1934, the Democrats swept even more seats in Congress and enough to push the New Deal and starting in 1935. Well, Obama did just the opposite, you see. In 2010, very same situation, bail out the banks, you know, bail out the corporations, leave Main Street behind, and the economy did not really recover. Jobs were still being lost by summer 2010, so what does he do? Well, he doubles down on behalf of corporations. That's when he puts this guy, Jeff Immelt, CEO of GE, in charge of his jobs and trade policies. The result was $800 billion more in tax cuts that I mentioned before for businesses. And he gets wiped out. The Democrats get wiped out in the 2010 midterm elections. And then, of course, it's the Republicans playing hardball ever after, and the Democrats and Obama attempting to somehow plead, let's work together, let's work together. You know, keeps extending his hand to the Republicans, and like the dogs, they bite it. Every time he extends it, it's just an invitation to bite it. But he does nothing about it, you know. Like I said before, the metaphor is beanballs. The hardballers are throwing beanballs at him. You know, and he's ducking, and he's striking out every time, you know. This guy is too much of a professorial type to really be president. You know, he did not want to step out and risk himself or go to the people. You know, can you remember him actually going on a tour to get popular support for his policies. I don't remember. Do you remember seeing him coming on TV and attempting to inform the American people about what they need to do to get these policies passed? No, he sat in the Beltway, comfortable in the White House, and played ball from the White House. Never went to the people. You know, presidents used to do that. I remember, you know, presidents going to the people, making tours, coming on TV, pleading for their positions to put pressure on this Congress, etc. Never did it. And, of course, historically, we know what happened, right? He talks about we need to throw ourselves into the task of rebuilding our institutions. Well, that kind of, that's a quote, assumes that the institutions collapsed, didn't they, on his watch? Yeah. So his two great legacies are accelerating income inequality in this country for the 1% and the destruction of his own parties. You know, now they're just, Democrats are just enclaves. Two-thirds of all the state legislatures plus governorships, you know, total control of two-thirds of the states now in Republican hands, and they're going to now solidify their control of the court system. The respected Pew P-E-W, it's a research, it's an independent research polling source, indicates that two-thirds of the people believe that Obama didn't keep his promises. Oh, but yeah, you'll hear, you won't hear that figure. What you'll hear is, oh, you know, his rating is above 50%. You know, which is high for a president going out of office. Well, just 2 years ago, 2014, it was as low as George Bush's rating when he left office. Okay, so he's gotten a little bump in the last year, but not much, right? So, you know, it's a big spin thing that people think he did such a great job, right? And he says, the U.S. Constitution is a remarkably beautiful gift. Yeah, with all the Electoral College in it. That's a gift, all right. The Electoral College. Right? No popular vote. No democracy. You know, the only country in the world that has a thing like that, among vast, you know, countries, that has a thing called Electoral College, where these individuals, who, you know, how the hell do they get appointed as an elector? Well, it's all backroom stuff, you see. And they got the right, constitutionally, to vote against. And a few of them did this time. You know? But they can do that. They can do that. They can reverse. You know, this is all a legacy of Hamilton. Hamilton is the guy, you know, back in the 1790s who was a banker and a merchant speculator and a slave trader who grew up in the Caribbean, right? Comes to the U.S., and he wanted George Washington to be king. You know, there's this big musical, you know, really doing, you know, spinning the whole reputation of Hamilton. Well, the capitalists like Hamilton. They like him because he's them, you see? He wanted Washington to be king, and he passed the first Banking Act, proposals Banking Act, and Manufacturing Act, and so forth. He has had a greater impact on the nature of the system here than ever before, and anybody else. And, of course, you know, one of his proposals was Electoral College and a whole other bunch of structural changes in the Articles of Confederation as they passed the Constitution in 1787, which eliminated a lot of direct democracy that existed during the 1780s and the Revolutionary War, giving power to the small farmers. Yeah, they changed that in the Constitution and they made it very difficult. You know, the two houses, a Congress and, you know, a Senate and a House of Representatives, right? And they made sure that the districts for the House were so large that it was very hard to mount a popular opposition and take over the House. And then the House, of course, the great Constitution, the Senate was not elected, was appointed. And then we have electors for the president, right? All these things. This is the great, beautiful Constitution. which is an anachronism today. It really needs to be reformed significantly, starting with eliminating this Electoral College and somehow ensuring that wealth is not free speech. You see, that's what corporate personhood is all about. Corporations are people now, according to the Supreme Court. And free speech for corporations means in spending money. Yeah, corporations are people. They have the same rights as you and I have as people. Now, tell me that's remarkable. All right, so, and then he says, if you're disappointed with those who are elected, then go out and run for office yourself. That's what he said. He, Obama, right? Yeah, sure. Everybody can run for office, right? It only takes $1 million plus to run for a House of Representatives seat, and $7 to $10 million to run for a Senate seat. And in California, it's even more. Big states, it's even more. Yeah, where are you going to get this money? Who's got this money? Well, yeah, you can get it from mom and pop. Every little guy put in $10. Yeah, no, that's such a fiction. Who's got the money? The guys who got the 97%, they got the money, and money is free speech. So, you know, that's a bunch of liberal nonsense. Oh, if you don't like who's elected, go out and run yourself. Huh? As if Joe Blow can run for office, right? And then he says, you know, I can't believe we pulled this whole thing off. Yeah, he can't believe we, in other words, that he got elected and he did all that he did, right? And he listed in his speech a series of accomplishments, you know, which I talk about in the article, Obama's Farewell Address, on my blog, jackrasmus.com, in greater detail, right? And he says, quote, we reversed the Great Recession. We rebooted the auto industry, generated the longest job creation period in U.S. economic history, got 20 million people health insurance coverage, halved the U.S. dependency on foreign oil, negotiated an Iran nuclear proliferation deal, killed Osama bin Laden, prevented foreign terrorist attacks on U.S. homeland, ended torture, passed laws to protect citizens from surveillance, and worked to close Gitmo, you know, Guantanamo. Sounds pretty good, huh? Hurrah for me. Well, look behind this a little bit. Yeah, the auto industry was rescued. The industry, the companies, auto workers' wages and benefits are still less today than they were in 2008, and the number of jobs in that industry are below 2008 levels. Ditto for construction. These two areas are high-paid jobs, right? Well, they're gone. They haven't come back, a lot of them. Okay, and then they say, well, we created 15 million jobs. Well, you lost 7 million on your watch, and you got them back, so you didn't create those. And then the rest of the jobs have been low-paid service jobs without benefit, part-time, temporary gig jobs, contract jobs. Right? Particularly younger folks getting stuck with these jobs, so that 40% of young workers under 30 today are forced to live at home with their parents. Because they don't have enough money to start a life of their own. They're cobbling together all these hustling, these little service jobs, part-time, temp, whatever. More people are working two and three part-time jobs than ever before. 5 million people left the workforce altogether. You know, it's called the labor force participation rate, more than 5 million. And their numbers don't get counted in the official employment and unemployment figures. If you count all these part-time temp, people who left the labor force, et cetera, you know, we got 10% unemployment. We got 15 million people still unemployed in this country, and that's probably an underestimate. What about ending the Great Recession? Yeah, it ended. Yeah. But for whom? Well, the 1% for corporations whose profits doubled, right? For the stock market, that tripled. The bond market, that tripled. And the $6 trillion in new tax cuts that result in the 1% getting 97% of the income. Okay, what about having the dependency on foreign oil? True enough, right? But at the cost of environmental disasters due to fracking irreversible water and air contamination in the U.S., which has been the case from the Dakotas to Texas to Pennsylvania. Right. Oh, okay, he said he signed the Iran deal. Okay, that's positive, but he left out mentioning that during his administration, the entire Middle East was set aflame with failed policy responses to the Arab Spring, with Hillary's coup, initiated coup in Libya. Yes, she's the one who did that, which he supported, Obama supported. She came to him and said, hey, I want, you know, get rid of this guy. It's good for my election coming up. Okay. Okay, Hillary, let's go and provoke a coup in Libya. And, of course, you got a failed state there, right? Support of other terrorist groups. We're even funding al-Qaeda in Syria. Did you know that? Yeah. Well, that turned out to be a bust, didn't it? Bet on the wrong horse there, Barack. And now the Russians are in the Middle East, winning friends and influencing people. And then we armed the Saudis to go attack little Yemen, right? Okay. That's the Middle East foreign policy. What about foreign policies elsewhere? Well, Afghanistan, 16 years later, we're still in a war. 13,000 American soldiers still there. And the Afghan government collapsing in the cesspool of corruption and graft again. We're still engaged in Iraq. And all these Middle East policies from Syria and so forth are destabilizing Europe with mass refugee flows, which have only been temporarily suspended recently because of big payoffs by the Europeans to Turkey to keep people from crossing. But the Erdogan government, which now is anti-U.S. because it believes the U.S. was behind the attempted coup here recently, to be seen what they do. Well, if they open the floodgates again, good luck, Europe. Right? Other failures on the foreign policy front, the U.S. Provoked this, the State Department, Hillary's State Department, run by neocons, provoked this coup in with neo-Nazis there in Ukraine and set in motion all of the conflicts and troubles there. Right. This was after, of course, the U.S. tried to get Georgia to invade Russia, even before that, which ended up in disaster. The Russians ended up taking part of Georgia. Right. That was John McCain's great plan. Now we got the remilitarization of the Baltics, and both sides are moving more and more people to the borders and arming the borders with potential nuclear weapons. Yeah, that's a great consequence, isn't it? What about the pivot to China? Well, China's currency now is a global reserve status. It's launched a major trade expansion and a pan-Asian investment bank that's been successful. And now they're forming a free trade zone agreement now that the U.S. TPP has collapsed. Oh, that's a great foreign policy record there in Asia. On the domestic front, well, Obama deported more Latinos than any other president in U.S. history. Yeah. Okay, so he gave, executive action, the DREAM Act, right? But he waits till the very, so he doesn't have to run anymore. Then he does this stuff by executive action. He should have done it in 2010 once the Republicans started blocking him and it was clear they weren't going to agree to anything he did. If he was any kind of an organizer, they say he comes out of, South Chicago organizing. I don't believe that. This guy does not have the mentality of an organizer. Aggressiveness, just the opposite, passiveness. He's like a university constitutional law professor. And what has he done for African Americans, you would think, right? What has he really done except talk, right, about all the police and gun violence and black lives murdered on the streets of the U.S.? Right? What has he done? I can't think of one thing. He talks, that's all. Of course, when it comes to free trade, he didn't talk. He signed agreements and pushed the TPP, right, aggressively. What you hear, in the press is, oh, his big legacies are the Obamacare Act and the Dodd-Frank Financial Banking Regulation Act. Right? Okay, Obamacare, I've talked about it many times on this show. I've been predicting since the beginning it would implode because it does not reduce costs for people. There are some good things about Obamacare, don't get me wrong. Like no limits on a lifetime expenditures. You can't refuse people with pre-existing conditions. Youth can stay on until 26, age 26 on their parents, right? And the best thing about Obamacare is the fact that they extended to Medicaid to 10 million poor people. That was good. Okay? And then we get 10 million more only out of the 50 million who are uninsured. 10 million more who sign up for these mandated programs here, buying health insurance. They're not the poor, right? And they were excluded for other reasons or couldn't afford. So now they, under Obamacare, they were able to get some kind of insurance. Well, but what could they afford? Most of the insurances are super high deductibles. With high copays, like $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 a year deductible before there is any kind of insured payback for these folks. Well, who's buying this stuff? People with great expenses. The other 30 million aren't signing up, right? Because even if you're middle income and below, below 40,000 or whatever it is, the rebates that you're going to get are far less than you're going to have to pay in premiums, right? So, it's not cost-effective for most people. But it costs the U.S. government $900 billion a year of bribery to the health insurance companies. That's what it is. You see, this isn't a health Reform Act, this is a health insurance company subsidy act. It has some good features, don't get me wrong. But the $900 billion of bribery for these features, was that justified? You hear, it's reduced expenditures. Well, sure. When you got a $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 deductible, you don't go and spend on healthcare services. Right? So the actual spending is not the same as the cost. The spending that they trumpet as the great gain here, spending reduction, is not the same as cost to the consumer of the program. You see, prices and costs have gone up. And, of course, I'm not even talking about pharmaceutical price gouging, which is going on and they did virtually nothing during Obama to stop it. Just some token legal stuff, right? Which is driving up the insurance rates even more, both for employer-provided insurance and Medicare, the pharmaceutical price gouging. We'll be talking about that and healthcare costs as this debate on Obamacare replacement intensifies very soon. Okay? All right. Another fact about Obamacare, keep in mind, it's $3 trillion of the U.S. total GDP, $19 trillion, is being spent on healthcare. That's like about 18% of our GDP is spent on healthcare. Yeah, and we've controlled the cost, they're saying. In Europe, in other advanced economies, Canada, Japan, and so forth, they spend on average about 10%. Some 8, 9, some 11, 12, about 10%. That's 8% more we pay. And that 8% is over $1 trillion. And that 8% that we pay more goes to, guess who? Paper pushers and insurance companies who don't deliver one iota of health services. Okay. It could have worked. Obamacare could have worked. Could have got the premiums down so that people could only afford to pay premiums for high deductible. They could have got afford to pay premiums for real coverage, right? If Obama had not pulled the public option unilaterally himself during the negotiations of the act. Yeah, that's what he did. He just pulled it off the table by himself. Biggest mistake ever made. Right? Well, you think that has something to do with the health insurance companies lobbying him and the Democrats? You betcha. And then the Democrats wouldn't even let the discussion and debates and the formulation of the act, any discussion on Medicare, expanding Medicare as a solution, which is the only solution. Expanding Medicare for all, sometimes called single payer. I don't know why they use that term, single payer. Why don't you just say Medicare for all? People can understand that. Hmm? No, and the Democrats are the people who introduced Medicare in the 60s. It shows you how far they've come away from what they were. This isn't the party of your parents and your grandparents, folks. This isn't the Democrat. This is the Democratic Party that was captured in the late 80s, early 90s, captured by corporate interests. Okay. True legacies, implosion of the Democratic Party, and accelerating income inequality, right? That's the true legacies, right? Okay, so not much for the rest of us over all these years, 8 years. Lots of hope that was dissipated. And, you know, that's why people turned away, I think, right? And that's the legacy of, as I see it. You know, it's not Obamacare, it's not Dodd-Frank. Those are two. Dodd-Frank, you know, is a joke. They passed a law in 2010, and they don't, and part of the law, they agree not to implement it for another 5 years. In other words, they give the lobbyists the second big bite at the apple. They give them 5 years to pick it apart. You know, they pick it apart in part when the thing's getting passed, the law's getting passed, and then they give them 5 years to pick it apart again. And that, of course, they did. You know, there's really not very much, if any, real measures that will do anything to prevent the next financial crisis, which is coming, right? And it is coming. Okay. That's my indictment of Obama's legacy, and that's my contribution to his farewell address, you know? Nice-sounding words, which is, you know, characterizes his whole 8 years. Nice-sounding words. But not a lot accomplished. Okay, Republicans had a lot to do with that, but he had a lot to do with letting the Republicans do that, you see. If he had gone to the people like FDR did in 1934, it'd be a totally different situation today, you know. But that's the problem, you know. Their Democrats are abandoning their base. We saw that very clearly. We talked about that. Okay, let's turn to Donald Trump. We're going to be talking about him and his policies more going forward here. But, you know, the past week here, the other interesting event was his press conference, wasn't it? And what did we see with that press conference was a purposeful leak, big-time leak from BuzzFeed, this, you know, secondary media outlet, BuzzFeed, about this dossier, right, about apparently the deep state and you know the NSA, the CIA, and so on and so forth, you know, are feeding information to the Democratic Party, or the Democratic Party is feeding information to the media and media outlets. And one of them was this publication by BuzzFeed of this memo that then got publicized by CNN, right, about this dossier on Trump that the Russians have, and the Russians are revealing it, and apparently this includes some salacious sexual stuff, right? And the mainstream media outlets had this thing before election and wouldn't go with it because it's unverified. know, it's just dirt and innuendo. But this is the kind of stuff you slander people with, and even though it's not true and it gets proven not true, the thought lingers with the public. Though, well, maybe it is true, right? Kind of stuff. And what it represents here, and this was released right before his press conference, so it became an issue with his press conference. And we'll talk about that next week, because it represents this ongoing attack on Trump by a certain wing of the elite in this country, and an attempt to tame him and bring him to heel, which I predict in another piece I wrote, Taming Trump, on my blog, jackrasmus.com, they will succeed in eventually doing. Okay, but well, that's another topic for another day, and next week we'll talk more about Trump policies and taming Trump, and Trump in historical perspective here. All right. Sorry for the break in the show, folks, but we'll see if we can patch that up, and next week, hopefully, the Internet stays up. Thank you. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio.